is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 5. I will look at the role NITs will play in 2024 with Naeem Alkhouri and Ian Rowe. Plus, from the vault, our first discussion of MASEF last summer. This final discussion includes a wrap-up of thoughts about GLP-1s, followed by me summarizing what we've covered in the episode and the other panelists agreeing with, modifying, or expanding on my comments. In wrapping up the GLP-1 conversation, Naeem Alkhouri discusses the patients for whom he would prescribe resmetirom versus GLP-1s. Lean MASH patients are obvious resmetirom candidates. Patients with F2 fibrosis and multimorbidities, diabetic, obesity, cardiovascular, are more likely to receive semaglutide. F3 multimorbid patients might receive dual therapy. I ask how the availability of tirzepatide instead of semaglutide might change the equation. Naeem expresses skepticism that tirzepatide will produce significant regression of fibrosis, but anticipates that dual or triple incretin agonists that incorporate glucagon will perform better on fibrosis. The rest of the conversation involves me testing whether the themes I've heard earlier in the episode are correct and complete. It moves pretty fast, covers a lot of territory, and receives some agreement and some corrections. After availability of a MASH drug, making proper use of NITs in diagnosing, staging, and tracking patients remains a critical challenge for 2024. There's a great deal to reflect on, and we cover a lot of territory here. So just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Naeem Alkhouri.
You know, Roger, just to add to the GLP-1 debate, I guess, I mean, I have no doubt that resmetirom will have a large patient population. Just a few scenarios where I think resmetirom will be used first is anyone with lean MASH. Obviously, if your BMI is 22, 23, but you have, you know, dyslipidemia, other risk factors, we think you have lean MASH, probably we're not going to go with the GLP-1. I think the second patient category is anyone who cannot get it because of insurance issues. And then third is patients that have been on a different GLP-1 or maybe even semaglutide. Not everyone is going to respond. Some people don't lose weight. There's that 5-10% that don't lose much weight. They lose 5-6 pounds and that's it. Some people lost weight, but they plateaued after, you know, they lose the first 30, 35 pounds, but they still have F3 fibrosis. And then tolerability is an issue. And I see also scenarios where we use combination. Again, if, you know, you have a very high BMI, uncontrolled diabetes, and stage 3 fibrosis, I really see no reason why I cannot prescribe semaglutide as a hepatologist to treat the obesity, which I do routinely, and also add resmetirom for the F3 fibrosis, because until I have convincing evidence that semaglutide is going to do that trick, I don't want to wait on someone and let them progress to cirrhosis. At least in the context of clinical trials, and I know this is very debatable, but in the context of clinical trials, about 20% of patients with F3 will progress to cirrhosis within 2.5 years. Again, this is probably not your typical general population, you know, F3, but still, I mean, that's terrifying, right? That you don't have, you know, 10 years to act on this.
Roger Green.
Okay, I have one more question and about the drugs, and then I want to go back to devices to wrap up. Tell me about tirzepatide. How does an agent that's maybe more effective and has direct liver effects change anybody's calculus or thinking about any of this stuff?
I'll tell you quickly, I do have to drop off, but tirzepatide, we don't think it has major, you know, liver-directed effects. I think, you know, the glucagon drugs like pemvidutide, survodutide, they have more direct liver effects, but tirzepatide is more potent in terms of the weight loss. I think we've had two major developments last couple of weeks with really amazing results with survodutide, which is from Boehringer Ingelheim dual agonist, more potent on the GLP-1, my understanding, than the glucagon. So that's why it still has a good effect on A1C. And then just today, there was a press release with Akero also, the 96-week biopsy data from the Harmony trial. And if you look at the primary analysis and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, not the intent to treat analysis, but still 75% with the high dose had fibrosis regression by one stage after 96 weeks. That's amazing, with obviously significant delta from placebo. And on top of that, about 1/3 of patients had 2 fibrosis stage regression. So I'm very encouraged by this, and I think it speaks to liver-directed effects. Going back to survodutide, from the press release, it seems like it had statistically significant effect on fibrosis, which is different than semaglutide.
Okay, so Naeem, first of all, I was listening to that, not seeing it. I heard that 2-level drop number, and that was totally ear-popping. It was almost like the plane dropping 20,000 feet at once, or 6,000 meters for the rest of you. Final question, Naeem, I'm going to ask you this first because you got to jump, and then we'll go in the order for us to go.
show. Here's what we kind of said today, right? NIT's messy landscape, even in terms of how to diagnose initially, we're probably going to wind up for a while on tried and true ASTA, ALT, GGT, maybe some kind of measure of stiffness is going to be what we're going to be doing to transit to track disease. That's not likely to change anytime in the future, in the immediate future.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think maybe doing a baseline test like our liver or maybe NIS2 plus to increase the positive predictive value to select the right patients. We may see more of this happening in the next year or two. And maybe if we are lucky to increase access to MR technology, at least in specialty clinics, we may do more like MRE and MAST score, MEFIB, potentially corrected T1 if we have better commercial access. But yeah, I agree for the at least disease monitoring. I think it's going to rely on simple things that we can do every visit, like ALT and liver stiffness, and maybe utilizing some of the new liver stiffness devices.
And then the other thing I think I heard along with that, just confirm real quickly, is that the blood-based biopsies that are coming aren't going to have an impact very quickly because they're not going to get here that quickly. That if anything's likely to happen quickly, it's going to revolve around the competition and increased use of VCT and other scanning devices.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, we're working on a couple of projects to actually implement these devices at the primary care and endocrine offices and hoping that we get support from pharma companies like Madrigal and Novo Nordisk so we can start upstream. And then as specialists, we are seeing patients that are more likely to need actually pharmacologic treatment.
Okay. Thank you, my friend. If you got to jump, jump. Everybody else, same question. What changes in the next year or two over what you're doing now, both in terms of initial diagnosis and tracking patients, if anything? And Ian, I know you've done a lot of work on different interesting composite strategies. And if you want to mention that for a minute now, it'd be a good time to do that.
Ian Rowe.
So I think the reality for us is that our pathway is so well established and does what we want it to do at the moment, which is to identify those with significant disease that is, well, particularly where we're not likely to have a drug to use in the clinic for at least 18 months and probably, I think, significantly longer than that. We are where we are and we've got the tools that we need.
And in the absence of a drug with the tools that you need today, nothing's going to change. It's going to kind of sit.
Yeah, that's exactly where we are.
Jörn, what do you see where you live and in other countries that you talk to? Because I know you talk to people all over the world.
Jörn Schottenberg.
More righteous use of LFTs and more awareness of elevated liver function tests in patients with a disease that's then druggable. I think there will be an uptake that takes time, but we'll be seeing a movement that actually moves liver out of the, there's nothing you can do about it. Shrug your shoulders, move on, have less alcohol momentum. I think we'll see more monitoring of ALFTs, we'll see more referrals from physicians, we'll see more patients inquiring about drugs, and we'll learn about the changes of the tests we have available today to be used and guide us on, you know, how long to use the drug. Of course, the question is on whom to start the drug anyways. I think this is a little easier than how long to use it these days. And you know, we might even go back to doing liver biopsies in some patients where we think this is debatable, this is borderline, or this is needed to influence a treatment decision. So it might be a little bit more of that because there's just more patients showing up. I think there's a clear momentum for the approval of drug in this indication.
Okay. And then Louise, last and certainly not least, what do you see on the ground in both the places where you're seeing the ground right now? And this week in England, last month, Australia, where do you see all that going?
Louise Campbell.
Well, I think Australia, I'll start there, is interesting because we're still pending the formal announcement of the new NAFL guidelines, which in September muted that they were going to still lead with ultrasound because FibroScan or any of the stiffness diagnostics aren't currently on Medicare. So therefore, patients have to pay for them themselves, which in the setting of resmetirom coming out would put them well behind the rest of the areas being able to locate and direct patients into care. And I think there's a genuine lack of knowledge in primary care. From the UK's perspective, I think we have an opportunity here to see how this could roll out. We are making potentially FibroScan more available to primary care and therefore the potential to locate and educate primary care, not only physicians, but nurses, staff and patients about liver health and liver risks means that we have an opportunity to take people off the timeline because of that better education and awareness and to be able to detect earlier by better engagement. Now, that's a massive task. And is the system set? Yes, we have a guidance, but we don't have a procurement system that's set to be able to deliver that. And therefore, it's going to fall on liver units to develop those outpatient strategies, if you can. So I think it's an interesting area that we're entering in the UK because we have encouraged primary care to get more access to this test to add on. So Ian's obviously done a lot of work in that. We're now going to see whether or not other areas can fit and increase those thresholds. So yeah, it's an exciting area, and it's nice to be part of it and potentially push that needle. But we're a long way off getting medication, as Ian states. And I have a feeling if we go through the NICE route, which we have to, that we don't have enough UK-centric data to be able to do that yet. I suppose Ian's the expert for here on that, not me. I'm just excited to get new toys to play with and to engage with patients. And the MetALD one with the new toys is... That we could really take off in primary care, because that's where the majority sits. And I'm seeing.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's episode, possibly a payer episode, possibly something else. Watch, listen to this space for details. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.